Addiction impacts all of us. Historically, resources for families of addicts and alcoholics have been few and far between. You're listening to the Voices in Courage podcast with K.L. Wells, where we help these supportive families understand the mind of an addict and transform amidst a loved one's addiction. We share hopeful stories, real conversations, and powerful tools, offering support and solutions to escape the chaos of addiction and shift into a life of thriving. We explore the challenges of isolation, shame, and shattered dreams, and share how to take back control of your life. Subscribe at voicesincourage.com and get access to our exclusive newsletter, blogs, and other transformational resources, and discover a growing community to help you thrive. Thanks for tuning in.
Welcome to Voices in Courage. I am super excited today to have Jen Lee Hurst with us. She is a full-time mom of two kids and has her own journey with alcohol and is now a sobriety coach. And I think you are our first sobriety coach that I've interviewed. Very excited. Yes, absolutely. I'm very excited to have this conversation. She hails from Minnesota. We're obviously coming out of Eugene, Oregon. And yeah, so welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm so excited to be here and to be your first sobriety coach on this podcast. What an honor.
Super. So if you would give us a little bit of the background, your own journey with alcohol, and what kind of prompted you to say enough is enough?
Yeah.
And then let's start there.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Like she said, my name is Jen Hurst, and I'm a sober coach in Minnesota, where currently we have a snow day. But I'm over 10 years alcohol-free, coming up on my 11th year. And after working as a brand manager for most of my life, I now coach women on how to boost their confidence in sobriety by implementing these really simple, healthy habits from the get-go and making this a really fun experience that you get to do as this incredible opportunity of what an alcohol-free lifestyle can do for you. My story coming up, yes, on 11 years, which is kind of crazy to say that because looking back at my drinking career, it's many people can attest to this, that it's two completely different people. Yeah. I think I'm going back to who I was, but also envisioning and stepping into who I was always meant to be. And I just had no idea yet. And I had no idea that my life was going to take me on this journey to becoming open about this, to becoming a sober coach. That was not in my cards, but also was not in my cards to become so addicted to this substance, to this drug, where it almost took my life. And as you wouldn't see that, you wouldn't know that with looking at pictures of myself from my before and afters on my Instagram page, where I always share before and afters, but I don't really have those typical before pictures of me in the hospital, which I was a few times. But I didn't take pictures of myself. This was 14, 15 years ago. We didn't really share as much as we did, as we do now. What I like to picture is how good I was at hiding it and how so many of us, especially women, hide it and no one knows what we're doing. Yeah. And I looked the part. I looked like I had it all together. I played up to that. And I grew up in a great family. My parents rarely drank. I did have an alcoholic grandfather who did get sober. So my mom was very close to witnessing this. She had to grow up really fast and take care of her younger siblings. Her mother died when she was young as well. I didn't have that typical thing, or else even when I did have my first drink at 15, I wasn't really addicted from the start. I did quote unquote typical normal drinking in high school and college. There was a turning point where my second boyfriend wanted to go on a break. And I did not want to go through that feeling of heartbreak again from my first boyfriend, where you have this intention.
Oh.
But it wasn't that really, the break wasn't really it. I was living with some guys at the time and they abused Adderall. And what that did for me was, and I said, you know what? I don't do drugs. So like, here, take it. You're going to feel amazing. You're going to feel like God. You're not even going to remember him. And I said, you know what? I don't do drugs. Little did I know alcohol is a drug. And I was very nervous about that. At that point, I was just didn't know what else to do to take me away. My heart hurt so much. I said, you know what? Screw it. Okay, let's do it. And I did. And I felt amazing. I felt on top of the world. I stayed up all night. I dyed my hair. I said, this is the best thing ever. And then the crash came. And then all those feelings came back and I was right back to it. But it instilled this idea and it planted a seed that taught me, oh, I never have to feel pain again.
Yeah.
I can just drink. Anytime I get nervous, as a classic introvert, I'm really shy. So anytime I got nervous, like to call a boy or to go to a party, that stuff really freaks me out. Actually, even before this podcast, I get really nervous. I've been doing this for years. I still get nervous. It's that the anticipation, and I talk about this a lot with the women in my groups, the anticipation of an event, the anticipation of a date, the anticipation of going on a work conference just freaks us out, and we don't know what to do with all that anxiety. And so I didn't. And the more I did it, the more I just became used to it. And again, it didn't happen overnight. It was a very gradual process. And I think that's what makes alcohol so dangerous, is that it happens more often than not, very slowly. So from the moment that I kind of thought I had a problem to the point where I actually got sober, it was a 10-year progression. It was really the year leading up to my wedding where I am a classic workaholic. I'm an Enneagram 3. I'm a perfectionist. I'm a high achiever. I was working full-time, doing freelance full-time. I was doing my wedding all by myself, not asking for help. And I would just drink to cope with the stress. Like, okay, you guys go out. I know I got work to do. I got to produce this to make money and to do this. And I wanted it my way. And I just slowly drank myself into a really full-blown addiction where I couldn't stop. And it was in this period where I would give myself these mini goals. It's like, okay, if I can go 3 days, and I would do this all internally in my head, if I can go 3 days, then I'm not an alcoholic. Okay. And then maybe I could do a day and then I would drink on day two. And I would do these mini goals and I could never make it. And I got so scared.
Yeah.
And it was really a couple days after my wedding, and I was very good at hiding it. No one knew what was going on, not even my soon-to-be husband. He had no idea. And my wedding day, it's a day that you're going to look back on for so many years, but it was really, it's so hard for me to look at myself because that was just the turning point. I was started drinking in the morning. I was taking Adderall to try to get through it and to lose the weight and to get everything done. And I was just full-blown anxiety. And I just said, just try to get through this day, just get through this day and everything's going to be okay. But it wasn't.
Wow.
I just collapsed basically 2 days after and I couldn't hide it anymore. I drank around the clock, even though I had been doing that for quite some time, and began my year and a half journey of actively figuring out what was going on, going to my first AA meeting drunk, my husband taking me, him finding out, us navigating our relationship as a newly married couple, me going into then my first outpatient because AA wasn't working, the sponsor, doing that, having periods, and then finally going into an inpatient at Hazel then in August of 2012. And we got married September of 2011. I love inpatient. I think it's fantastic. I think
I totally agree.
It was some of the best times, if I'm being honest. Like, oh, I don't have to worry about work. I can just focus on myself. And I'm around women who get me.
Yeah.
And we just get to hang out and we get to have fun and we get to talk about things. Even though the first couple of days are so scary and I was coming off, I was in withdrawal, but I also knew I wasn't fully ready. I really wanted to get sober. I just wasn't ready. I'm like, I'm just going to try it one last time when I got out. And though I was feeling great, doing awesome. And I did. And of course, it just led me right back to where I left off, went back into inpatient, did their extended care stay. Again, with this idea that, okay, I'm still not done. Still not done. And I was taking Adderall as well. In this period, I was also dabbling into other forms of alcohol, like mouthwash. That was my drink of choice, actually, for the last 2 years because of the extreme shame that I felt of going into a liquor store. And I learned in treatment, that's actually a mouthwash. I could just drink that. And I can just go to Target and no one has to know. And I don't have to hide. And little did I know, I think I did at that point, I just didn't care, but it just really started to destroy my body. But I'm just someone who had to take it. I'm very tenacious. And if you say I can't do something, I will prove you wrong. And I'm going to try to make this work and I'm trying to hide it. And I just started to feel myself dying at the age of 31, which is pretty crazy. I got two DWIs in this process, one in 2005, the second in 2013, right before I got sober. But in this period, my husband kicked me out of out of the house because I was drinking. About setting those boundaries as a family member, he set that boundary. If you drink, you have to leave. I understand how hard that was for him and also for my parents, who love me unconditionally, but they didn't know what to do with me. They said, sure, the treatment, this is supposed to work and she's not cured.
Right.
What do we do?
Right.
Like, we love her, but she can't drink in this house. It was really on April 23rd of 2013. I was going to the office with my dad because they had to keep tabs on me. I had to be watched all the time, which is doesn't help, but it just made me want to drink even more, to be honest. Supposedly, I blacked out in the middle of the day and they took me to detox. I blew a 0.34. And that did, it scared me. But the fact that I've been doing that for the past 2 years, I want, and there were way other more times that I don't even know how close I came to not waking up. And I had searched cardiac arrest actually on my childhood bed before going in because I was taking Adderall. I was drinking mouthwash and I felt my hands going numb. I'm like, my heart was pounding out of my chest. My pulse were so bad. And so my hands were shaking so much that I didn't know. I thought I was going to be going into cardiac arrest, but I didn't want to freak out my parents. It was in that moment in detox where I made the decision. And many people describe a click moment. Even though that can happen as this divine awakening, it can happen in just in the process of going alcohol free, of doing 30 days off, and you kind of realize, oh my God, what am I doing? It was like I had an out of body experience where I looked down on my bed and I was so scared. No one was talking to me. My parents didn't know what to do with me. I was calling homeless shelters, but it was in that moment. I had court the next day for my DWI. I'm like, what am I doing? And I just decided then and there that I was done. And I'm like, I fully surrender. I have no idea what's going to happen. I have no idea, but I let go of the outcome. And I told myself the only thing you need to do is not drink. As long as you don't drink, you cannot make this any worse. I mean, I had a lot of stuff to clean up. I don't know, but how I was going to do it, but I just started taking things one thing at a time. I didn't expect anybody to believe me. Because how many times did I say, this is it? I swear, I'm so sorry. I just shut up and I just started doing the next right thing. And it felt so freeing because once I took away the fight of trying to make this work, I just knew it. It got so much easier. It's hard to teach this because it's internally a shift that happens. It's a mental decision that you make with yourself. And you've got to really want it and you have to be ready. I just wasn't ready before. And on April 24th, I was. Mm-hmm. And I went to my last inpatient stay. I did all the things. I got my parole officer. I did my day in jail, 4 months pregnant. I got a job at a local printing shop because I didn't have a car because of my DWI. I just made it work. And it's amazing what can happen when mm-hmm. you just remove one thing.
Right.
Because like I got that job just at a local printing shop. And then mm-hmm. I found a job back in my field 4 months into my sobriety. I started mm-hmm. going to the meetings, doing all of the aftercare that they recommended. I just started showing up and I just started right. doing it. God, it was just felt so much easier. And then within 4 months, we learned I was pregnant, which is something I really wanted. And with something that was planned, my husband saw the change in me and saw that there was a difference, that it could be time that we could start to try. And then in 6 to 7 months, I got a promotion. When Landon, my son was 6 months old, we bought our first house. And it was all these things that I envisioned for my life that I never thought possible. And I visualized before I went into my last inpatient mm-hmm. that came true. And now even better. I never did I imagine us living in the country, but gosh, imagine my life now in the city and having mm-hmm. chickens. We have like chickens and we have four cats. We started with two and I'm like, what's another two more? Chickens, what's another 15 more? And I'm not saying it's perfect.
Sure.
But I'm truly living life and I can get into how I became a sober coach too, but that's really my story of starting out to where it led me mm-hmm. as a way that it started with pain and heartbreak, then led into anxiety and trying to drink to calm my anxiety, and then mm-hmm. where I couldn't stop. And then how much I tried to fight it and how much alcohol had a grip on me.
Right.
Even though I didn't want to do it, I had to do it because I didn't know any other way. And I was so low. And I imagine myself in my later drinking months had dug myself into this big hole. And I, mm-hmm. this is just the vision I had. And I had no idea how I was going to get out.
Right.
I had no idea. But I just never stopped trying. Mm-hmm. And sometimes mm-hmm. you just have to let someone struggle enough until mm-hmm. they wake up and they really want it, because forcing someone to get help often doesn't work unless they really want it. And that's so hard as someone who loves this person, or if it's mm-hmm. your son, your partner, to let them do this to themselves.
For family members, for friends, it is one of the hardest things to understand is that we can't be angry with them and force them into getting help. We can't shame them into getting help. We can't say, I remember one moment I had with my son and I said, I can't lose you. Well, I was saying that from just heartbreak, and that was not anything that was going to move him. And I think there's this desperation, like you talked about being in the hole. It feels like that to us too. We fall in the hole with you. It just looks a little different because we're in desperation trying to figure out how do we help you? And it's a really weird thing that we actually really can't. We can love you with boundaries. And learning to do that well, I don't know how many people actually learn to do that well. Because it is such a higher level of love and the whole self-care component to it for those of us. We have to do the same things you do.
Yeah. That's why there's Al-Anon, right?
Yeah.
That's why there's the family programs and treatment, because you go through your own recovery process as well.
Mm-hmm. The challenge is that, relative to the family pieces, there are very few places that do have family programs. When you look across the country, being in Minnesota, you had one of the best programs in the country with mm-hmm. Hazleton. I have friends who have been to Hazleton. And then Al-Anon wasn't a fit for me because I wanted to thrive in the midst of this. I didn't want to just live in the crisis of it, or I didn't want to just survive this. The aspiration that I had for who I was going to become in the midst of my son's disease didn't match up. Then what? Which is why Voices Encourage got born. It's just a really interesting dance of our journeys. It's all about elevating on both sides of the equation. Our own consciousness and what it really truly means to be alive and thriving.
Yeah. I love that word, elevate. I'm even thinking of a next level course, and I'm thinking of some empowering words that even just got me thinking, like, oh yeah, elevate's a great word. Breakthrough, all of those terms to step into who we're always meant to be.
And I think it's a continual process. For me, it is just embedded in who I am. I'm always learning, I'm always striving, so on and so forth. But the level of heartbreak in watching my son deal with this disease was so, I think originally kind of catastrophic and at the same time catalytic in a really powerful, uplifting, elevating expansion of my consciousness and who I am in the world. And again, like I said, how do you actually thrive in the midst of the disease? So there's a lot of pieces to all these things. And I loved that you kind of touched on the whole notion, number one, how captivated you were by the shame of your disease. As somebody who watches from the outside, it's mind-boggling to watch what somebody in addiction mode will do for their addiction. It doesn't make sense. And then, so I had to do some brain science work to figure out their brains have been hijacked mm-hmm. and the disease takes first position in terms of survival. Good to know. And when they ask for money, they're not asking you as a family member. You're just kind of a mark, so to speak. It's a transaction. If you're not going to give it to them next, just drive on and make that happen. Learning what's going on in somebody's head who is in addiction mode is a fascinating understanding. And it's a little bit hard to get your head around, too.
So, yeah, and I would do anything for that fix, or really it's to take me out of the withdrawal.
Right.
Withdrawals were so bad that even when the lengths that we'll go to protect it, to hide it, hiding it in this bottle, and even years into my sobriety, I would still find bottles or still find, like, my God, I swear this wasn't here. I don't even know. And this is such a common thing. It's like, oh my God, I found this here and I've hide it in the bush, and just to take us away, to take away that pain, to take away that feeling of uncomfortableness. You'll just go to any length. When the mouthwash was, I went to alcohol to mouthwash. And then when the mouthwash, they figured out the mouthwash. Okay, what else can I do? When they took away my money, then you get into the thing of, okay, maybe I can steal. How am I going to do this? Okay, I have to sneak out of that. It's so exhausting going into hand sanitizer. Okay, maybe if I do that, then I could get some sort, you know, I went into rubbing alcohol, anything. And it's like, you just don't care. Like that's, that is, it truly is. That's your number one goal, but not for everyone. So for the gray area drinker, it might not look like that. Or, you know, maybe you just kind of overdo it sometimes. But for me, my kind of regressed to an extent where it was a means of survival. And that I hope that people don't get to that point, that we can gather the knowledge and put out the knowledge and seek out and put out that there is help, that you can join these groups, that you don't need alcohol to have fun. You don't need alcohol. Alcohol actually is really bad for anxiety, actually makes your anxiety so much worse.
Right.
Just giving people the information so they can make a conscious choice in this journey to combat all of the advertisements and brainwashing that we were kind of being fed, that we need this to become some, to thrive, like you were saying, to elevate our experience. No, you actually don't. It's actually taking you away, but you have to reprogram your brain in many different, and basically your every single thing that you do and learn and convince yourself that, okay, I don't need alcohol to have fun. Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. I can actually go to this and have a great time. But I need to be open to experience that first. But that's my hope, is that people don't get to that point. But if you, if they are, it's not, you don't need to give up hope. And I think where I was, that you could have easily given up hope, they can turn their life around, and you can turn your life around. If you've suffered enough, if you've kind of taken it to the point, but it's so hard to let them. And there's a great podcast. And I don't know if you listen to Mel Robbins. You listen to Mel Robbins? Okay. So she has the let them theory about letting them do this, letting them experience this journey, that we can love them and find compassion for them, but we can also detach and, like you said, set those boundaries to protect yourself, but also having the family member getting to a community as well, finding a community, finding other people who are just like you, who are going through the same experience. That's huge.
Right.
You got it. You need that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a business coach, and in the business world, it's all about 95% of your success or failure is directly determined by who you surround yourself with. So whatever aspiration you have, you have to surround yourself with people that are holding that aspiration or have arrived at that aspiration in order to like rewire your thinking and to be around that higher level of thinking and being in the world. And we have to, we're habit machines. It's habits of thought, emotion, and behavior. All that has to be rewired in the midst of this disease, whether you're dealing with the disease or whether you're witnessing the disease. We still have to do our rewiring too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me about the journey to sobriety, coach. I'm super curious about that.
Yeah. Like I said, I never thought this is going to be my life. But now I always thought that I was meant to do something great.
Yeah.
And I just didn't know what that was. I thought that was being an art director for magazines. I moved to New York. I'm like, I'm going to be an art director and that's going to be my thing. And I always envisioned I'm going to speak on stages. I just don't know for what. As a brand manager or graphic designer, I was scrolling social media at night, like I think most people do, back in 2017. And I've always been into fitness. I kind of even cross-addicted in my periods of sobriety before I actually got sober. But so I'm very careful about it. But I started doing Beachbody, and which is now Body. And I loved it because as a mother, I could work out at home. And I never had to think about what I was going to do before I would go to the gym. But now as a mother, I can't just, I can go to the gym, but just mom guilt, all of those things. So I love that I was able to do that at home. I had a coach and I found her scrolling and I'd seen her transformation. And I was like, oh my goodness, this woman had biceps and strong abs. And I'm so motivated by that. I was like, that is absolutely incredible. I'm just going to follow her, which I never did. Mm-hmm. And then I saw she went to this summit for a Beachbody held. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to sign up as a coach. There's reason that I'm following her and I'm really interested in this, even though it's completely out of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
And so I started doing that. And part of the process of becoming a coach is you got to share your journey. Now, this was before Insta stories, all of those things. So it's about sharing your life on social media. And within 2 weeks, I told my husband, I think I need to come out. And I had been in the sober closet for 4 years. I did AA, but we were taught to be anonymous and you don't really talk about it. And I felt some kind of shame about it. Like, I didn't think anybody cared. I didn't, mm-hmm. no one asked me about it. It was kind of hush-hush, like, don't bring it up. Don't have alcohol around her. I'm like, you guys, I want to talk about it. Why aren't you guys asking me? Mm-hmm. But it's their problem, or they don't need to ask me. And so I said to my husband, I think I'm supposed to come out. How are people supposed to trust me as I'm mm-hmm. selling these products, which I loved, if they don't understand this huge part of my story?
Right.
And so it was September. I like to think of my journey as two recovery dates, April 24th of 2013, and then also September 7th of 2017, because that was the day I came out of the sober closet.
Okay,
and
great.
And I declared it on social media. It took me 2 minutes to write, maybe three. And it felt so freeing to write that. It was so easy. And I basically said, hey, I'm Jen. I'm an alcoholic. This is why I drank. This is what I do. And I wanted to put it out there. And I think... Mm-hmm. This is preparing me for who I'm supposed to become. I posted it. I was so scared. I went into my AA meeting. I didn't look at it. I'm like, I cannot believe I just did that. And then I came back and I looked. I'm like, so much love, so mm-hmm. much encouragement. And mm-hmm. it felt so good to have that weight lifted off. And I just said, right. I don't have to hide anymore. I can just own this. And I didn't mm-hmm. come... just so easy for me to just start putting the stuff out there. I just sort of breadcrumbed it in the mm-hmm. next couple years of helping women, doing my before and afters of my weight and doing this program and the results that I had. But I would also sprinkle in these little tidbits about my sobriety. And I realized over time that ones that I shared about my journey and my story were the ones that people were interested in, that I got the most messages about. Mm-hmm. And I went to a Rachel Hollis conference too. And I had this idea of, I think I might be supposed to be helping women get sober. I don't think I'm supposed to help them lose weight. I think I'm supposed to help them get sober. Maybe this is just building the foundation for something else. And I didn't really know. And I was really torn of what to do. And I still had my full-time job. I had two young kids at home mm-hmm. and I was doing this on the side. And it was there that I just got this experience of, oh my gosh, it was life-changing. Personal growth conferences are amazing. Like the mm-hmm. biggest dopamine that you can have. Way totally higher than alcohol and last far longer. I said, what if I did this for sobriety? Of like, oh, I just feel so alive and so amazing. What if we could rebrand it as something that's so positive, not like toxic positivity, but just positive. And not that people have to do it, but they mm-hmm. want to do it because how good you can feel. And that mm-hmm. when you get sober, it's not just about not drinking. It's so many other things. And I always felt, and I was told nothing wrong with AA, but if I didn't go to a meeting, I was going to relapse. I'm like, oh my God. But I'm like, I'm not.
Right.
I'm doing all these other good things. I'm moving my body. I'm doing all this. And with Beachbody, I started reading personal growth books, which mm-hmm. were transformative in my mindset. Right.
Yeah.
I was taking really good care of myself. And I was like, this stuff is working. There's something to it. And people are asking me how I'm doing it. I just started this idea, but it took me a long time to kind of let go of the job. I actually quit my job in August of 2022 to become a full-time sober coach. But I started with private coaching. I started mm-hmm. taking on these clients. I've always struggled that I'm not good enough. I started just researching programs. How do I do this? How can I help someone? But I think with sobriety is you learn through experience.
Yeah.
As someone who had 5 to 6 years, mm-hmm. something was working in what I was doing. And mm-hmm. people learn through that connection and that experience. Mm-hmm. And so I just navigated and I started coaching private clients, but I had this idea, I want to do this together because we're mm-hmm. stronger in groups, we're stronger mm-hmm. in numbers. I want us mm-hmm. to go through this process of day one on to day 30, day 60, day 90 together, because then we can start a movement and then everybody can start helping each other mm-hmm. and not taking someone just starting on day one, let's start now. I want to take you before we even start. Mm-hmm. I want to go through what possible withdrawals you can experience.
Right.
To be careful, tools to have on hand. So I really walk women through step by step.
Wow.
Through this process, whether mm-hmm. they're already sober or they're looking to get sober. Mm-hmm. And then I also incorporated these habits into my programs that are designed to help you feel better when your dopamine mm-hmm. is low coming off alcohol. You're going to feel really tired. You're going to feel sad. You're going to feel anxious probably.
Right.
And so what are some good things that are going to help you through this process? It sounds so stupid, but it's drink water. Feed your body, which is a really big component for mm-hmm. this. We have to repair and rewire our brains.
Right.
And we can do that and help increase the blood flow through movement and gratitude mm-hmm. of switching this into a get-to mindset, reading, mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. going to give you the knowledge that you need to offer clarity to what alcohol is doing to you and mm-hmm. what sobriety can do for you. And all of these things, checking in with a group. I wanted you to let us know, how are you doing? Let's check mm-hmm. in. Did you stay sober today? And just navigating this process of how to live sober, of what I would have wanted, even though those experiences at Hazelden were fantastic, they didn't really teach me how to live sober. Real life scenarios, I break it down. What do you say to people?
Right.
How do you set a boundary? What
yeah.
food is going to be really great for your liver and your brain? Why is exercise important? What to mm-hmm. carry with you to an event? You always mm-hmm. pack a cooler. Mm-hmm. What to do with anticipation anxiety? You're feeling mm-hmm. nervous. Oh, how do I work through mm-hmm. that? Mm-hmm. And so taking them through this process together and cheering them on and giving them the rewards for tracking mm-hmm. these habits. So they mm-hmm. get that little tiny boost of dopamine for showing up for themselves, that it's not just about not drinking.
Right.
You're starting to show up for yourself so you overall feel better. So it's going to be more likely that you're going to want this change to stick because you feel better. But like you said, it's so hard because if someone does fall off, it's hard as a coach to let them do that, especially mm-hmm. when these things are virtual. But then to know they can always come back and that there's right. no judgment. I don't expect you to be perfect. This process is not perfect. Mm-hmm. I just want you to stay connected to us and I want yeah. you to finish this.
Right.
Knowing that your journey is going to be all over the place.
Right.
But the fact is you're still going up. You're still mm-hmm. trying. And that mm-hmm. is the key
yeah.
for everything.
Right. Do you know, generally, the people that you're working with, how well supported are they in their families, in their communities? I mean, I watched a lot of different things with the people that Sam was doing drugs with. A lot of them, their families were done. Their friends were done. They had just outlasted everybody that had loved them, really. Then you're building from square one again. Number one, I can feel how loving and heart-filled you are and how this creates a safe place for people when actually most people don't have a safe place.
At home?
Home, life.
Yeah.
I mean, isolation is one of the biggest issues right now in our society, and we don't know how to build community. We haven't skilled up. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think COVID was a huge magnifier of that fact mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. we haven't skilled up in terms of how do we connect with people in a meaningful yeah. way that is true and authentic, all the things that kind of swirl around that.
And I think the women coming into my groups, a lot of them are with a partner who drinks a lot. I think that's a really big topic in my groups, is navigating life if your partner is continuing to drink. And what do you do when you're trying to live this life and you have someone else that's not in agreement with it, or who supports you, but they're still going to drink too?
Yeah.
But I think what I can offer women too is a safe community, just like you said. Yes, we are virtual, but then as this community continues to grow, and what I think we do really well in my groups and also in my Lighthouse Sobriety membership mm-hmm. is we do keep people engaged. The ones who choose to, I can't force you to be engaged. Mm-hmm. The ones that do, putting them in a really tight-knit community and then mm-hmm. breaking them into Marco Polo groups in my groups and also in my memberships, have them connect with these women on a more intimate level. And these women are creating best friends. I had just two women meet up in Disney World and had their kids meet up. And then also gathering together with retreats. So I'm hosting my third retreat here in the fall. So getting together in person, but also inviting them to look outside and to seek right. out that community in person. That's great to have virtual.
Yeah.
It's also even better to have in person. Could we create some mini retreats? How to reach out and to find those members? There's organizations like the Phoenix has sober events and meetups. There's many sober retreats. There's Sober in the City. All of these ways you could even go mm-hmm. to an AA meeting just for the community piece to meet
right.
up, seek yeah. out some other people. If they don't have that at home, if people have cut them off mm-hmm. to seek out that community, whether mm-hmm. it's virtual, which is fantastic, where there mm-hmm. are so many options virtually,
right.
but also, you know, in person if they can as well, knowing mm-hmm. that it can take time and patience for the family to come around. If you have made that decision that you are done, that mm-hmm. you have to give them time and patience for them to kind of come back if they do. Mm-hmm. But the most important thing is to take care of yourself and mm-hmm. seek out that community, because you might join a community mm-hmm. and it's not the right community for you.
Right.
You're just like, it's just not my thing.
Yeah.
And then you'll try it another. Oh yeah, that actually is. Do you like co-ed or do you just like all women's or all men's? So it's kind of a preference in what you're kind of looking for. Are you looking more for spirituality? Then mm-hmm. you can seek out that. There's so many great free Facebook groups too for that too. But
yeah.
to really seek out and surround yourself with people who have the life that you want.
Correct. Absolutely. We have an aspiration for a million thriving on our side of the aisle. Because what I find is that most people are losing themselves in the disease of their loved one because they're trying to fix them. They're trying to save them. They're trying to keep them from dying. They just kind of give their life over to the disease and they lose themselves in the midst of it. And so my thing was, I said earlier, that was not my aspiration. My aspiration was to, because I have a great life. I was like, I still want to have a great life. I still want to live in the thriving of this fantastic life. And I have this one part. I want to learn how to navigate this in a thriving space. What do you think about the course of your journey in terms of what does thriving mean to you?
The first words I think of is like taking life by the horns and just living life fully and really stepping into your potential. You think of like your goals and dreams and writing down your goals and taking care of yourself. And maybe it is feeling good in this process and finding joy in the journey. That's really what I think thriving is really finding that joy, stepping into your potential, doing what you really want to do and what you're really good at, mm-hmm, what brings mm-hmm. you joy, what we could do for mm-hmm. hours that not getting paid for it, and something that just makes you happy, I think. And I think for me, it's also, if I feel great when I help other people and to see other women thriving, I think in their sobriety and the lights mm-hmm. come on in their eyes and the, mm-hmm. you see the sparkle come back and they're starting to smile. It's, oh man, that's the
does it get any better?
Joy ever.
Right.
I think it really comes down, and I think my groups, it really comes down to feeling good and doing mm-hmm. the things that you enjoy and taking care of yourself. And are mm-hmm. you doing what you love to do? Is where you are at in your life, is it something that you really love to do?
Right.
And where you see yourself, you know, this is the one life we get. We don't want to go back. We can't go back. And so
I think it's really fascinating. I'm quite a bit older than you are, and I've seen the decades of discussions that weren't happening around what do you love to do? The way that I think about it is our lives are, we're picking up puzzle pieces all along the way that telegraph to us where our passions are, where our love is. And then eventually the picture begins to reveal itself as to what our divine purpose is mm-hmm. and what we're supposed to step into in this lifetime. I loved how you talked about your own unfolding in that.
It's kind of funny how life turns out and directs you into what you were meant mm-hmm. to be and your purpose, even
right.
though you had no idea. And something that I never shared about, I was so scared to talk about, is now the one thing I love to talk about. That's all I talk about, really.
Right, right.
And now it's my career.
Yeah.
And I never knew that.
It's until a little trippy.
It just kind of presented itself to me. Mm-hmm. And I tried to fight it. And I said, I'm not good enough. Who am I to coach right. other women? And then I found yeah. that it was working. It started really in my DMs and my messages, and women would mm-hmm. write me and I'd write them back and I'd voice message them back and like, oh my mm-hmm. God, that was so helpful. And you helped me. And now I'm a year sober. I'm like, really? Oh, okay. And then I'm like, there's something here.
Right.
And I guess this is what I'm supposed to do. And it's working. And it's just a different way. I do a pump up playlist and just these different stress relieving activities, like just in a way to help you. Again, it's this whole conversation of wellness and taking care of yourself. And just like mm-hmm. you said, it's like little mm-hmm. puzzle pieces mm-hmm. in this road of life. It's also little puzzle pieces as you navigate what's working for you in your sobriety.
Yes.
Again, it's not just meetings. It's also, what are you eating? If you eat like crap, you're going to feel like crap.
Right.
Are you moving your body? Well,
right.
okay, let's do that. And is it essential? Like all of these things are just this puzzle piece that kind mm-hmm. of creates your life and your sobriety. And it all just kind of fits.
Yes.
You kind of tweak stuff along the way.
Yeah. I recently did a whole workshop on emotional fitness. And that's not emotional intelligence. Emotional fitness is all the things that we're talking about here is our body, our mind, our soul, and our physicality and our emotional set, so to speak. And how do we take care of each one of those? Because each one of those are the stools of the legs of our lives. And each one deserves kind of an exploration to discover, as you're saying here, what are the things that I can do that really brings me the most vibrancy in my physicality, or the most vibrancy in I wake up every day with gratitude and I am embarking on this day from a place of, I personally set intentions every morning. It's love, serve, impact. And just all these different things that we can do that actually brings us the most vibrancy in our lives, that we can live more fully and be more present and more aligned with actually who we really are, who we're meant to be, and the impact that we're meant to have.
Absolutely. And I think that starts in the morning too.
It does.
How you set up your day. You sound kind of sound the same as me as starting my day with silence. I always say today is going to be a great day. And then I envision myself, how am I going to have a great day today? Mm-hmm. And box breathing, and then do my reading. And then I'll write my goals down, write my gratitude down, and then move my body. And then I get ready. And that all happens before anybody else wakes up. So if I can do the work on myself before the day starts, officially starts, then I'm going to have a great day. And then that great day is going to stack on top of another. And then I'm going to have a great week. And that, again, stuff is going to happen. Not every day is perfect. But it's like the work that you do to kind of set yourself up for success, to have you feel good and in alignment of telling your brain, what do I want? What are my big goals? And what are my intentions for today? What do I want to accomplish today?
Yeah.
And when you can do that and start showing up for our lives, things just kind of start falling into place.
And when life shows up and knocks us on your butt, you are better prepared, having stacked the successes and, for lack of better terminology, all these emotional fitness pieces, you've been stacking them and growing them. You are better prepared to kind of surf with what shows up in your life in a way that, you know, a lot of people aren't, because they're just not skilled up. I think all of this is skill development and learning, and we can go from really crazy things that have happened in our lives to flipping it and using it as our message and our purpose. And that's very much what it feels like in having this conversation with you, is that you've taken arguably the biggest challenge of your life and flipped it on its ear and learned how to take it as a gift that's catalytic to creating this version of yourself that we see today, which is light and bright. And I'm super excited to see as you progress and the trajectory of the impact that you're going to continue to make.
Thank you. I think one of the coolest things is being able to meet these amazing women.
Right.
And I never knew. And I said, well, gosh, we just all get along so well, and you're so brilliant. And it's because that's what the message that you're putting out there, that you can, there's that quote, you can turn your mess into your message. And you meet the people who are attracted to that. And I also want to feel good, and I want to move my body, and I want to do this, and that you can turn this into something really great. And in turn of me helping other people, it's also helping myself stay sober. And it's helping myself just never forget where I came from and what it took. And there's certain strength that can come when you've personally been through it. I know how you feel. Not exactly, but I've been there, all of it. And this is what's worked. And I hope that you can take it, and that we're all on this same road. And this is what I like to describe as, for any woman coming into this comparing, oh my God, you're 10 years, or I see her and she's 5 months. I'm like, we're all on the same road. And the thing that connects us is that we're just the same, and maybe if you have heard this, they were the same exact distance from the ditch. We're one decision away from turning it around. Now, we're also one decision away from getting sober and turning this around. We're also just one decision, but we're all on this path. We're all moving forward. I'm just a couple miles down further. So I can tell you, and I can look back and be like, hey, there's a speed bump. There's an obstacle up here. You may want to take a detour.
Yeah.
So I can just give you a little bit more guidance of what's down the road. So you can decide, do I want to take the detour or do I want to go through the rubble? It's up to you.
We're
all the same distance. I'm the same distance as well. You're one decision away, like Mel says, from a completely different life. Whole thing is, we're all moving forward. And so,
One decision away is absolutely the truth. And the notion of you're 5 minutes away from the miracle. And so many times, that is just the honest to goodness truth. And you have no idea who's going to join you on the journey that's going to transform your life.
What if it all works out? Again, I'm just going to Mel Robbins you all the time. What if it all works out? What if this was the time?
Right. Right?
And you're this close. Mm-hmm. And if you give up now, you're going to miss it. You just have to keep going. Have to keep going. You're this close. This time could be it.
That went fast. What I want to say is just one thing that you could share with our audience that really mattered to you in the midst of all of this and transforming your own life and creating the life that you have now and continuing to create the life that you will create. What's the one thing that's the biggest needle mover?
Offer advice? Well, things that I wanted to hear. I think honestly, the past few years, one of the biggest things that's been extremely helpful for me is box breathing. It sounds so simple. Taking a deep breath.
Right.
But if I could offer anyone some advice, number one, everything's going to be okay. That it's okay to feel discomfort. Yeah. That's actually, and I heard from another podcast that that's actually the cure for everything. Your ability to sit with discomfort and figure out ways to go through that. And that it's nothing to be ashamed about. There's nothing wrong with you. But those were the things that I really wanted to hear. But I think that discomfort piece is huge. But I think especially the box breathing has been transformative in the groups for that just split second. And again, another Mel Robbins at you. The power is in the pause.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
Pause before you react. It can help calm your central nervous, your nervous system. It can prevent you from doing something you regret. It's just one of the easiest ways to manage to reduce stress. But you just have to remember to do it. And then you can manage and navigate anything that comes your way if you can learn to manage your breath. It's all related back to your breath. And that's been really helpful for me.
Awesome. That's great. I love it.
It's so simple. Take a deep breath, guys.
And it is the simplest things that actually help us.
That's right. And Glennon Doyle said, it's usually the harder the problem, the easier solution. What do you need? You need to get some rest. You need to go for a walk. You need to take a deep breath. You need to drink some water. You probably need to eat. It goes back to the halt. Am I hungry, angry, lonely, tired? Do I need to eat something?
Right.
I probably just need to take a nap. I need to go for a walk.
Yeah.
And you kind of forget about these things and it's not going to cure all your problems, but it's going to make it so much easier to process them if you just apply some simple tools before you react and go to just your instant, let's just take a deep breath and assess for a sec.
Right. Well, we could talk about this all day long. What I want you to do is just tell our audience where they can reach you.
Yes, I like to hang out on Instagram at Jen Lee Hurst, JenLeeHirst. Otherwise, you can go to joinlighthousesobriety.com for upcoming groups and my membership for women and anything new that's coming up as well.
Awesome. Well, this has been so much fun. You're delightful. And I just want to say thank you for who you are and the work that you're doing and the light that you are and all the lives that you're impacting and helping people on a road back to themselves and then to the next best version of themselves. So thank you for joining me today. This has been just really awesome.
Thank you. You as well. Thank you for the work that you're doing as well.
For sure.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. If you're looking for help to go from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos with the right tools and resources, subscribe at voicesencourage.com. We encourage you to share with friends and family going through similar situations so we can continue to build a strong community of hope and possibility. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.